You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
On a lonely hill, high up on the Isle of Man, sit a ragged stone house and farm. At night, the wind blew through cracks and made strange noises. And, as with all homes, other creatures sought to enter and find shelter. And then, late one night, scratches and whispers began to come from behind the walls and in the rafters.
I'm the eighth wonder of the world. I'm an earthbound spirit. I am a freak. I have hands and I have feet. And if you saw me,
my name is Jack.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith. For 67 episodes, Dr. Karen Stolzneau, Ben Radford, and I have been examining stories about monsters and using them to discuss the facts behind the legends. We've used monsters as a springboard to talk about science and critical thinking. We've interviewed lots of fascinating working scientists and laymen. We've talked to skeptics and believers and neutral parties. We've boldly podcasted where few have podcasted before. This episode's topic is very special to me. The night I met Ben and Karen at DragonCon some years ago, we all talked monsters, and one of the ones we brought up was this unusual and lesser-known creature called Jeff, the talking mongoose. It's taken us this long to get to Jeff, and I'm delighted at the interview we have for you. The guest is Christopher Joseph, and he wrote a great article for 14 Times about Jeff and is currently working on a book on the topic as well. I really hope you enjoy this interview. But I must also warn you that this will be the last episode of Monster Talk. For a while, I'm taking a break for a variety of personal reasons, but we'll be back in July with new episodes. I'm not going to drop off the earth, but I do need some time away. Monster Talk, when done properly, takes a lot of time, and I don't want to do this show poorly. You deserve better, and I demand better of myself. So please hang in there. Please stay with us on our Monster Talk Facebook group, and this summer, Monster Talk will be back with more monsters and science.
Monster Talk.
Today on Monster Talk, we're talking to Christopher Joseph. And Christopher is the author of one of the most interesting write-ups on Jeff the Talking Mongoose that I've come across. Jeff is a monster or a creature or a phenomena. We'll get into that. That has been of interest to me since I was probably about 11 or 12 years old. And I know a long time interest to Karen as well.
Yeah, I think it's one of the few articles as well.
Yeah, well, they're right. There's not a lot written about it, although we'll get into that as well. So let's just say welcome to Christopher. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So there are a lot of ways we could start talking about this topic. The way I usually see the story presented, it starts when a man named Harry Price gets involved in the case. But let's just start at the very beginning if we can, maybe just take it sort of historically. What is Jeff the Talking Mongoose and how does his story begin chronologically?
Well, he first started to appear in
the autumn of 1931 in a little village called Dalby in quite a rural part of the Isle of Man. And pretty quickly his fame started to spread in the local area and various neighbouring villages and the town of Peel. People were getting quite intrigued by what was going on. So it was quite rapidly in the Isle of Man press. Then it crossed over to the mainland, to the North of England newspapers, which is about the time Harry Price heard about it in sort of spring of 1932.
What was Jeff, and according to the stories, and what were some of his antics?
Okay, so the Irving family lived on a very remote farm. There was James Irving, his wife Margaret, and their teenage daughter Vorrie. And in around September 1931, they claimed, and we have to stress that they, a lot of the evidence we have is really just what the Irving family presented to us with, although there is some other evidence. They claimed that a little weasel or rat-like animal had appeared to them, firstly outside in the farm yard, and then inside the farmhouse. Now, their farm was built out of stone, but it was very cold. It's up on a mountain. And they had lined the walls with some kind of wooden matchboarding. And there was a gap between the stone and the wooden matchboarding of about 4 inches. And they were claiming that this little animal had kind of got, kind of like squirrels get into attics, that they'd got into the inside of the house. And they said they very quickly, they heard it sort of repeating noises back to them. And then it was making animal noises. And very quickly, they claimed it learned to talk. And the whole thing started from there, that it sort of took on this very intelligent ability to learn, rather like children learn to speak, but in a much more compressed, you know, within weeks. And then it started to roam around, spying on local villagers, reporting back gossip. This is where it begins to get weird, because apparently it would go back to the Irving family and say, oh, Mrs. So-and-so is knitting a new hat, or the farmer down there has lost his sheep. And these were apparently very local, kind of humdrum, rather boring events, but that these people said, well, we didn't tell you. How did you know that? And that's some of the kind of supporting evidence. That he used to go down to the town of Peel and spy on the bus drivers. There was a big bus depot, and he used to go and apparently steal their sandwiches and report back to the Irvings. And say, he described one of the bus driver's houses, and the bus driver said, well, I live alone. How did you know? You haven't been in my house. No one's been in my house. I'm on the first story. How did you get to know this? And this farmer Irving insisted, well, it's this little talking animal.
It's neat to me, because like as a grown up, I read this story and go, well, that's extremely unlikely, right? But as a child, when I would hear the story, and we had a frequent problem with squirrels in my attic, and then the write ups talking about how that Jeff would scamper around behind the boards, but he was an animal, but he had human hands and could talk. It was very creepy to me, and he
was bilingual too. He could couldn't he sing in Welsh and Manx and Spanish and Yiddish.
That's right. Yeah, all sorts of little smatterings of different languages that he apparently picked up. Although it must be pointed out that James Irving was quite a cosmopolitan character, and he travelled around. He wasn't an Isle of Man person. He used to work in Liverpool, and he was a commercial traveller, and he travelled around here and there. So there is certainly aspects of him, his mind and his interests, that kind of dovetail with Jeff's. The same with the daughter, who was very interested in mechanical engineering and aeroplanes and tractors. And Jeff would go down to the airport and he'd report back and say, oh, I've just seen this particular biplane fly in. And you know, there are certain similarities. He liked the food he ate. Wasn't the kind of food you'd expect a weasel or a mongoose to eat. It was more like the kind of food that you might think a teenage girl might like cream cakes and bacon. But that said, it can't just be explained as a hoax, although that is what, to anticipate maybe what we're going to get onto later, that is what some of the local people felt was going on.
Yeah, it's interesting. I maybe we should start here and then go to the next stage where this man named Harry Price gets a hold of the case and decides to investigate. But this is not a small thing. I mean, Harry has quite a public reputation. So can you tell us a little bit about Harry Price and what his character was like before he got involved with this particular investigation? How would people know his name? Is he an everyday name, or what kind of a reputation or public figure was he?
Yeah, certainly at the time he was very, very widely known. He was a psychic investigator who had had a private income, so he was able to indulge his interests in as he saw it, exposing fraudulent spiritualist mediums, and if he found that the odd one or two that he felt was genuine, he would investigate those. And because of his private income, he managed to build up a lot of what he said was kind of scientific equipment with which you could measure the veracity or otherwise of spiritualist mediums. He investigated the Schneider brothers, Rudy and Willie, and he first came to public attention when he exposed a fraudulent... Have you come across these spirit photos? It was a big thing after the First World War, I think. I mean, it may have been at its inception Victorian times, but this was a big thing after the First World War. People were trying to contact their dead relatives, and there was a circle of spiritualists up in Crewe in the north of England, and this chap Hope claimed to be able to photograph people, and when he developed the photos, their dead relatives would appear on the image. And Price, this was that was quite a big thing at the time, that he managed to expose this, that there was some kind of sleight of hand. So he had a reputation of being not a gullible man, because he said, you know, if someone's a fraud, I will expose them. But if I think they're genuine, I will try and investigate and eliminate all the possibilities of hoax or fraud. And I think with the Rudy Schneider investigations, he was fairly convinced. Also with people like Stella C, other mediums.
He was also very famous for investigating Bawley Rectory too. I think that was one of his biggest.
Of course, yes. That was the. I think there's at least two books he wrote about Bawley. Although there have been some allegations that he slightly, how shall we put it, hyped up the goings on there. I don't know if you want to go into that or not, but he wasn't without his critics, and he was certainly very. Very adept at generating publicity for himself.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't know how to put that exactly, but yeah, he is a so like in America we'd say he was a grandstander.
Yeah,
absolutely. He really liked PR, and from what I understand, he did an investigation of this. He wrote a book called "The Haunting of Cash and Gap." Is that right?
That's it.
And then he also did at least one radio piece dedicated to this on the BBC radio. I haven't been able to track that down, so I don't know if there's a recording of that or not.
A lot of this stuff is quite hard to track down. The book that you mentioned, The Haunting of Cashin's Gap, is it's quite hard to find. I mean, I don't own a copy. I've seen copies. It was quite a small print run, and they didn't reprint it. And I think this is partly why the story of Jeff hasn't been as widely publicised as maybe it could or should be, is that the actual sort of primary resources, if you like, are rather hard to come by. So that, yeah, the broadcast he did doesn't appear to have been archived by the BBC, which is strange because it was the Talking Mongoose stuff. Once Price got hold of it, it was big, big news, and it was in not only the UK press but internationally. There was reports going over to the US, and there were claims of rival talking animals. I think it was treated as there's not a lot much else going on, and it's the Depression. You know, things are a bit gloomy. Let's try and lighten the mood with some crazy talking animal stories.
But the actual what I've read of Price's work. I mean, aside from that, he also wrote about that investigation in other books, and he usually took it very. I mean. He did not dismiss it as a hoax completely in anything that I've read. He said there were some suspicious circumstances involved, but there were also some very peculiar things going on as well. So it seems like the case has elements of, if a talking animal is supernatural, maybe that. But also, Jeff seemed to throw things ostensibly from behind the wall. So, it seems almost like a poltergeist case, except. And I actually read an account last night from a book that was written in 1950. I forget which author it was, but he said, and it's not just like a poltergeist case. It's also very similar to a hobgoblin in that you've got almost like a spirit. And even Jeff says himself, he said a lot of things, but one of the things he says, he's an earthbound spirit. And he seems to have, like say, quasi-supernatural powers. He doesn't act like a ferret or a mongoose. He kills animals and leaves them at the Irving's house, but he chokes them to death, which is a strange thing.
Yeah.
It's a hodgepodge of very implausible but hard to research claims. And then wasn't he?
He was very rude as well. He used to insult people and spit on them.
Yeah, he was very foul-mouthed. He was very obnoxious and quite touchy and temperamental. But I think that does dovetail a little bit with some of the other poltergeist cases where the Bell Witch, it's sometimes compared with the Bell Witch case. And, you get some kind of entity from wherever it's coming from, whether it's inside these people's minds or if it comes from elsewhere. It can be quite argumentative, threatening. Jeff never actually hurt anyone, which I think is unlike the Bell Witch case, if I understand that correctly. But he certainly threatened to kill people's poultry, shoot them, and he was very touchy about being photographed or being seen, although a couple of people did say they'd seen him, aside from the Irvings, that is. I think there are a lot of close... Sorry, I was just going to say the poltergeist links. There are quite a lot, the banging, the knocking, the throwing things.
And I think he did bite Mrs. Irving once, didn't he? And then told her to put some ointment on the wound.
Yeah, well, that was her fault because she was stroking his back and then she got a bit carried away and put her finger in his mouth, which he obviously then bit. And she complained about that. And as you say, his response was, well, go and put some ointment on it then. It's your fault. I've... a bit of self-promotion here. I'm currently writing a book about Jeff, and the chapter I've been looking at this last couple of weeks was Jeff a familiar, a witch's familiar, because something that Harry Price remarked, that if this had happened 300 years ago, the whole family would have been hanged as witches. And I initially thought this was kind of a throwaway remark, but having looked at some of the 17th century, early modern accounts of particularly English witches' familiars, there are quite a few polecats, ferrets, small animals. There's one woman as hanged as a witch in London who had a squirrel. And there are some points of comparison, but it kind of begs the question of what is a familiar. And, you know, a lot of these women were just being tortured and they'd say anything. So it doesn't really take us that much farther. Although it is quite striking that it's kind of an English tradition, and the Isle of Man, as you probably know, has loads and loads of old legends, both kind of Celtic and from Norse, the Viking influence coming in there. And yeah, there are the stories of these helpful goblins and boggarts who will stay in your house and they'll help you out if you feed them, which is kind of what happened with Jeff. He used to get given food and he would catch these rabbits and he would find lost sheep, because they were mainly sheep and goat farmers, the Irvings. So in that sense, he does kind of parallel these old traditional stories of helpful brownies, I think they're called in Scotland. Sorry, I'm running away. I get very carried away when I talk about Jeff. I get so excited. But
No, yeah, it's okay.
Interrupt me as you will.
So let's go back to Harry Price taking this story to the media. So... Okay. You said that the media ran the stories, but maybe there was nothing else going on. This was lighthearted fare. I mean, were people – I assume this was being – this is my bad memory, but it's being released in installments as the investigations go along. Is that how this happens, or how long does the story go on in the media? Is it just a series of updates, or does Harry just release one big investigation?
Well, what happened is, and it's interesting that the Irvings themselves didn't contact him. It was a friend of theirs on the Isle of Man who wrote to Price and said, look, they're really perplexed about this thing, this entity, and you're the top man in this field, and could you investigate? Now, initially, he didn't go up there himself. He sent one of his investigators, an ex-naval man called Dennis, who he thought was a very shrewd and reliable person and not easily hoodwinked and so forth. And Dennis did have two or three experiences where he heard the voice apparently of Jeff, and he was convinced it wasn't the daughter, which was the obvious supposition. Price did go up there with the editor of the Listener magazine, R.S. Lambert, who's the co-author of the Cashin's Gap book. Nothing really happened to him up there, and I think that's partly why he shifted his position from thinking, oh, there might be something here, this is extraordinary, to, I think this is a hoax. So he had his article, as you say, he had the radio article, and then the book came out 4 years later in 1936, but by that stage, it was kind of diminishing a little bit. Jeff's visits became less frequent. He was still around, but he'd kind of go away and come back and then say, I've just been around the island. He seems to have, what shall we say, as the daughter grew up, she was 12 when this first happened, so she was going through puberty, so again, you have a poltergeist possible connection. As she grew up, Jeff's frequency of visiting seemed to get less and less, until by the time she was an adult, he wasn't really around.
I think one of the accusations was made against Boyrie, wasn't it, that she was a ventriloquist?
That's right, and there's I managed to track down an interview with a wonderful old lady who had been to school with Vori, and they were friends. And she said, yes, it was a hoax, and it was the mother and the daughter. And the motive she gave was that they wanted to move back to Liverpool, which is where they'd originally come from. I mean, Vori was born there, but the mother and the father had come from Liverpool. And, you know, why are we're really poor, we're cold, I smell of goats. That was Vori's nickname, Goaty, because she was, had to, you know, why can't we go back and live a normal life where I could have friends? That was the suggestion by some of the neighbours. And certainly this lady who had been her friend said she could throw her voice. Although I've also learned from professional ventriloquists that this idea of throwing a voice is a myth anyway, that it's just a misdirection by stage ventriloquists. So one doesn't really know what to believe. Apparently, I mean, I can't do this, but apparently if you can't make your voice emanate from another part of a room, you can merely misdirect your audience to make them think that is happening. But maybe that's what Vori was doing.
Yeah, it just seems like she was teased a lot in school for the claims and...
Yeah, but you know, and it's interesting to me because for every easy explanation, there's a complication. So, people said when Vori wasn't around, sometimes they would still hear Jeff. You know, so it always makes you think. Well, how do they know? And could the mother also do this trick? You know, or you know, would any phenomena that happened be attributed to Jeff? Whether it was him or you know what I mean? Like, so if something falls over, nobody's near it, does that become Jeff versus the wind, you know?
Yeah, I think there was a real heightened sense of expectation. And apparently scores of people used to go up to the farmhouse. You know, there was no TV in those days. There was little entertainment. And this was a big thing in the neighborhood. And they'd all go up there and try and listen out. And maybe they could hear him or see him. And it got to the stage where Irving had to put an advert in the local paper to say no visitors unless by appointment, because he was getting tired of all these unwanted visitors coming up and invading their house.
Now, if I remember correctly, he was a former piano repairman or piano salesperson?
That's correct. Apparently what happened, he had quite a successful business before World War One, and then it kind of all collapsed. So he just invested his last couple of £100 in starting this new career. And the connection with the Isle of Man is that his wife's family came from Man. It seems a bit of a jump, but
It does.
And it didn't work out well either. I think he had, you know, plans to be a successful businessman. And initially they employed people. But as the depression started to bite and money got tighter and tighter, they ended up doing all the work themselves on the farm.
So what about what Jeff was? Could it have been possible that it was a mongoose? Were there mongooses on the Isle of Man at the time?
Well, I was surprised to find out that there were. Certainly there were 20 years before this took place. There was apparently a neighbouring farmer, it's about 8 or 10 miles away from their farm, who had imported, I think, 6 or 8 mongooses, or mongi, to...
I wasn't sure about the plural there.
No, mongoose something.
Mongoose, yeah.
There's loads of rabbits and hares on the Isle of Man, and there are no foxes. So the foxes aren't present to control the rabbit population. So if you're a farmer, you might think, oh, I've got to do something about this. So this is apparently what this other chap did, imported mongooses from India, presumably. I mean, this is the days of the British Empire, so there was much more traffic and trade with places like East Africa and India. I have heard of a couple of reports that there are still mongooses in this area. It seems extraordinary because it's not really the kind of climate you'd imagine mongooses would thrive in, but there you go. Jenny Randalls, you know about Jenny Randalls, the UFO investigator? She was on the island about, I think it was about 10 years ago, and she saw this kind of yellowy beast going across the road, and she thought, oh, that's funny, what's that? I know it's not a fox, because I know what a fox looks like, and anyway, there aren't any foxes on the island. And I met a local chap, who was quite a nature person. He knew quite a lot about animals, and he said, yeah, I saw this thing. It was kind of like a polecat, but it was the wrong colour, and I think it was a mongoose. So there were mongooses on the island, but they weren't talking ones, as far as we know. They were just rabbit-catching wild mongooses. He also wasn't the right size. I mean, the Irvings described him, and one or two other people said they saw him, and they described him as a little 6-inch animal with a 6-inch tail, kind of more like a squirrel, in my opinion, or a weasel. But mongooses aren't that small. They're much bigger, and they have a different tail.
Years later, a farmer says he killed an animal that he thinks might have been Jeff.
Yes, he was the farmer that took over the farm after Irving died, yeah.
Did he actually produce a body, or did he just say that is it possible he just said that so people would stop bothering him?
No, there is a photo. There's a photo of him holding up this carcass. It was in one of the local papers.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But it's kind of not really Jeff-like. It's a big thing. It looks to me like a big old polecat, or I would say badger, but again, they don't have badgers on the Isle of Man. It's a very odd kind of place. It was too big, unless Jeff had grown, or maybe had grown a lot and changed colour. He said he kind of heard it prowling around and he saw it, and then I think he snared it. And then in the end, he went out in the morning and shot it, I think. But it never talked.
It didn't beg for its life, and I think Jeff. He had a lot. He was proud, but not that proud.
He would have disappeared or changed his shape or something. He would have pulled some stunt.
Speaking about the body of Jeff, there was some physical evidence for Jeff, wasn't there, that the family had produced and presented to Harry Price?
Yes. Now this is where it gets a bit dodgy because under great pressure. They took some photos of Jeff, or maybe you were thinking about the hair, the fur samples.
I was thinking about all of that. Yeah.
Yeah. The hair, yeah. The fur, the imprints.
The imprints. Yeah. Yep.
Jeff was very reluctant to be seen. And he said he only exposed himself to the Irvings just so they'd believe. And they saw his shadow sometimes by candlelight. Just to add, there was no electric light in this house. So you have to imagine quite a dark and gloomy atmosphere, and possibly conducive to seeing little flickering shadows and things. They just had oil lamps. Must have been quite grim. But anyway, yeah, he did consent to have photos taken. They weren't very convincing. I mean, I've seen a few. You probably saw some in the Fortean Times article.
Yeah, we'll link to that in the show notes. There are some. I mean, honestly, that's some of the best photos I've seen of this story.
So I appreciate those being put together.
They do tend to vary, I think. What you see in one picture doesn't necessarily resemble thinking of the one on the fence with a tail curled over.
Yes.
It looks kind of like a squirrel, but with kind of chipmunky stripes. Now, that's different to the description they gave of him, which was a little yellow animal with a sort of a bushy tail, black-tipped tail. Then the hair samples, well, he was purportedly giving some from his tail and one from his whiskers and one from his back. And when Price went up there, he found out they had a sheepdog called Mona. And he surreptitiously managed to take some samples of Mona's hair, fur. And sure enough, he had them analysed. He sent these to the Zoological Society of Great Britain. And the chap there said, yeah, these are the same. You know, what you've got here are dog hairs. So someone's pulling someone's leg, whether it's Jeff or it's Jeff, yeah. The Irvings or, you know, something's going on.
And these findings gave him pause.
Yes, pause for thought, indeed. Yeah.
So with the photographs as well, I think you said that it's likely that they might have been some kind of toy that was made in Europe at the time, or a pelt.
I just wondered whether if one assumes that it wasn't Jeff catching the rabbits, but the daughter, which she did do with, she went, you know, she was known to do this off with the dog and catch rabbits herself. Could she have maybe used the rabbit skins, the furs, to fashion her own novelty mongoose that she could then position? I don't know. It's just a suggestion. When another psychic investigator by the name of Nandor Fodor, quite an interesting chap, he was a psychoanalyst from Central Europe, he went up there, and actually his investigation was more thorough because he stayed at the farm for a week. He did have this suspicion that there were some kind of little toys, and he went through all the drawers in the house looking for them and couldn't find anything. Although that's not to say that maybe they were concealed outside in the hedge somewhere.
Yeah, it looks like there's lots of slate. It would be easy to hide stuff under.
Yeah.
There was I was going to ask about Nandor Fodor. I thought that, yeah, he's a very interesting character as well. And then he did his own independent investigation. And where was that published?
Well, there's a couple of – he initially published them in, I think, the Society for Psychical Research journals and bulletins and proceedings. But he eventually published them in his own books, Between Two Worlds. It's got a nice chapter on Jeff. And something called The Haunted Mind, which is quite an interesting one because it brings in his psychologist's hat connected to his paranormal investigation side as well. And he initially thought – oddly enough, for a scientific kind of man, that this was a talking animal because of the physical evidence of Jeff eating and drinking and urinating in the house and spitting on people. But he later changed his mind and he thought it was somehow some kind of emanation of James Irving's thwarted ambitions. And he's not too clear about how this could happen, but he had a more of like a psychoanalytic reading of it that, oddly enough, not the daughter, but the father.
And for some reason, that reminds me, weren't there claims as well that Jeff could shapeshift into other characters or other creatures and that he could become invisible?
There were certainly accounts of things happening where you couldn't see him. There were some people fixing the road, some workmen just down the road from the farmhouse, and they'd stopped for lunch, and one of these characters was having his sandwiches, and he threw a bit of bread away. I think it was rotten or stale. And then he saw this bread moving along in the fields with nothing apparently, you know, attached to it.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like, I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever, crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
And he threw a stone. He was scared. And then the stone came back. Now, you don't really, there's not much cover up there. I went up there to see the site of the farm, and these are quite open fields. There aren't any trees or bushes, really. It's quite open land. So it's hard to see if something had been hiding. There was some fishermen went round to visit the house. And this is at the time all the people were visiting. And one of these guys said that a small white cat had leapt up on his lap, and the Irving said, "Well, we haven't got a cat. You know, we've never had a cat, and we've got no neighbours. This is a house isolated on its own, 2 miles away from the nearest houses." So, yeah, the supposition was that Jeff was kind of transforming his shape, possibly a little bit like other poltergeist cases, like the John Wesley case, where an entity appeared as a badger. And this is something that's been taken with some seriousness because, as the founder of Methodism, it's Wesley, you know, and he's reported this as a young child. His father wrote down there was all these weird things in the parsonage, Epworth Parsonage in Yorkshire. Actually, that badger was called Jeff as well, strangely, but I don't know if we want to get into Jeff's throughout the ages.
Yeah, were they spelled the same?
Jeff is very unique.
Yeah.
That was his spelling, wasn't it? His phonemic spelling.
Yeah, he was trying to spell G-E-O-F-F, but he couldn't really spell that well. But hey, you know, you've got to give him credit for being able to spell at all.
The Irving's house, actually, it surprised me. It was much bigger than I expected. I don't know why. So was that house already there and they bought it, or was it one that he built with the money that he spent?
No, it was built in the middle of the 19th century, and it came up for sale. So he bought it and tried to have it made a bit more homely and, you know, lined the walls and repaired it a bit. There was a strange character that lived there before, actually, someone called the Old Miser, the Old French Miser, and he's kind of an interesting guy himself, but he was a free thinker and an atheist. And he had some weird association with the Secret Service in Europe, and he was on the run, and he ended up owning lots of property. And I got really excited about this because Jeff, in his long discussions with Irving, said something had happened in this, and Irving said something had happened in this house, and it was that kind of old trope of a haunted house and a murder. And I looked through all the reports, the newspapers from that area, and nothing had happened. And this old miser chap, well, he wasn't really a supernatural kind of person. He was just an eccentric character, and I think even the fact of him being a foreigner was quite unusual for a quite insular place like the west of the Isle of Man. So yeah, do we want to talk about the paw prints and the weird human hands? I know you've mentioned the human hands.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
So obviously, again, when I heard the story the first time, it was from a book. I think it's the book's called The House That Bled. I actually, in preparation for this interview, I actually went back onto a used bookseller online and actually tracked down a copy of this and bought it. And I found out that I would have been about 11 years old when I read it. So that was kind of fun.
And I was about 8 when I heard about it. I think it was from one of those Usborne books, just a compilation of supernatural stories.
So, the human hands freaked me out. And, of course, if you ever see a raccoon, their hands look very much like a human hand. The front paws do. They're very articulated. But I kept in my head – also, I was a big fan of H.P. Lovecraft and is it Brown Jenkin from the Witch House. And she has that little familiar that is like a rat with human hands and a human face. And I kind of in my mind combined these things together to just have a very frightening mental picture of what Jeff looked like.
I'm actually convinced without any proof as yet that Dreams of the Witch House was inspired by the story of Jeff because the timing is about right. I think Lovecraft wrote that in about February 32, which was just at the time when the story had broken out from the UK press and was going nationwide. I've had a look through Lovecraft's letters, hoping that he would say, I've just read this weird story from England, and there's no mention of it. So I'm kind of hoping, and as I'm writing this book, I'm going to have to look into some of this more, that I could find a New England newspaper from the period that would have a little column about weird goings on. And but it's one of those things you may not be able to prove. It may be just a weird coincidence.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with research like that. I'm still trying to track down. I don't really have proof, but when I was trying to run something to ground about when the first historical reference to a particular paranormal thing was, and I can track it down to two authors who are probably the source. It's one of those two. I'm inclined to think it's one of the two, but both of them made the same mistake, and the mistake was repeated, and that's where I'm trying to track down what was the source. Both of them independently came up with the same wrong story.
So you're hoping to find the original source,
right?
But you may not find it. Yeah, sometimes.
Right. Exactly. I think when I finish writing this up, it's going to be, I think it was this guy, but I really can't prove it wasn't this lady. So
yeah.
So sympathy to you, sir.
So did you want to continue talking about the prints or?
Yeah. So what happened with the handprints when they put them in plasticine, which epoch, but the plasticine.
Yeah. Jeff said, you leave the plasticine or whatever it was, the clay up there, and I'll do my stuff. And he later left his imprints of his teeth marks and his front legs and his back legs, the claws. And it was the case that the front paws or claws were much bigger than the back ones. But again, when this was sent down to the Zoological Society chap, Price's contact there, he said there's no known animal that has such a disparity between, you know, his little back legs and a little mouth, his little teeth, and he's massive, you know, it's impossible. I'm not an expert, but having looked at those photos, it looks like they might have been made with a little stick or something. I sound like an arch skeptic now, and I think with the story of Jeff, I found myself lurching from, no, it's a whole hoax, the whole thing is made up, and thinking, no, there is something extraordinary going on here. In that case, it does look like it was made by the daughter. What animal would have human hands if it's 6 inches long? It doesn't make sense. But he was able to light matches and hold a big metal torch and bang on the walls with his tiny fist and make such a loud noise that it echoed around the whole house.
Which is creepy.
Creepy in the extreme. Especially as he would talk all night and sing and keep them awake.
I was going to say, did anybody outside of the Irving family ever report actually seeing Jeff?
There's only seeing him. There's only one or two I've heard about. There was when Nandor Fodor went up there, and as I say, he was there for a week, so he interviewed all sorts of local people and tried to build up a much more thorough background to the case. He managed to track down two young lads, one of whom they both said they'd heard Jeff in the house, and one of them said he'd seen him running along a field just down the road. There was also a man who stayed in the house overnight, and he said he could hear all this whispering, and he looked under the bed. He could hear this thing talking to him. He saw a pair of little eyes staring at him from under the bed. Those are the only two accounts of people other than the Irvings having seen him. There's quite a few people who claim to have heard him, but that's something different.
And sorry, Blake, did you want
to go ahead? No, I would talk the whole time. You go ahead.
Didn't you mention in your article that Price mentioned somewhere at the start of the book that they had a talking parrot in the house as well?
Another
pet?
I could answer that. Price was staying down in town during his investigation, and he went up to the Irving's house, didn't see anything, came back, and as he wrote it, he said he was having a hypnagogic dream when he heard the voice of Jeff, and then when he came to full consciousness, he realized it was actually the voice of the parrot in the kitchen across the way, and that he had just thought that he was hearing Jeff. So
in the house, or
it was in the host who was taking care of them when they were on the island had a parrot, and he or she kept it in the kitchen. And so through an open window, he heard the parrot.
I see.
So I just read that last night when I was preparing for this. So that's why.
Complicate things.
And that's actually from Price's account in a different book where he's just kind of doing like little brief overviews of various investigations. I still haven't been able to track down a copy of The Haunting of Cashing Gap.
So. They come up now and again on eBay or ABE Books, but they tend to go for about £100 plus.
Oh my gosh.
They are rare because, as I say, only 1,500 copies were printed.
Well, they were rare. The one of the versions I read last night, a retelling, mentioned that the book was hard to find in 1950, that it was extremely hard to come by. So it's not going to get better. although if it's under a private imprint, maybe somebody could get a digital copy and maybe make it available. That'd be nice. But the trick is it's just tracking down who owns the copyright and whether they're willing to do a digital reprint. That's the question. So, but that's another issue. Investigators who like to, or you know, any kind of historian who wants to look at old material, it can be very frustrating when there's a limited print run, or if there were multiple versions of a book, but only a few copies made. It's just so tricky. But I'm very passionate about getting back to that primary source material when I can.
It was also quite a problem for James Irving, the farmer, because he had initially wanted to write his own book. And these were desperately poor people. I don't know if we've emphasized that or not. He had quite a good living when he was a piano salesman. By the time the whole Jeff stuff was happening in the early 30s, he was desperately poor, and he had his wife and his daughter to feed. He wanted to write his own book, and Price, rather naughtily, I think, said, "Oh, you know, there's no real market for that. I wouldn't bother." But he was writing his own book, or co-writing. The arrangement they came to, I've seen letters, is that they would pay royalties if sales went above a certain amount, which they never did. So they really were just giving him a few quid here and there, but they were very reluctant to actually pay him because, of course, it would render his whole diary evidence and letter evidence useless. I know this is a question that a lot of people have asked, were the Irvings getting any financial benefit from it? And I haven't been able to find any. They were offered 3 guineas once for some of these photographs, some of the ones that we've seen. And he refused. This was from a newspaper in the north of England. Now 3 guineas would be quite a lot of money to them when they were earning about £1,500 a year, I think it was then, which was, you know, for 3 people. So it's hard to see why they would have refused that. There was also, kind of Barnum-style impresario who telegrammed James Irving and said, I'll give you $50,000, half immediately up front, if you give me exclusive rights over Jeff to tour the States. And he turned that down. So I don't think financial benefit was the motive. Neither did Harry Price. He thought there was some kind of hoax, but he thought it was more on a kind of psychological, it's hard to put into words. I think that he felt that the extreme isolation of the Irvings, particularly James Irving, having been maybe quite an important man in Liverpool and, had quite a high social status and good standard of living, that he felt this very deeply. Fodor also believed this, that it had caused them to have this kind of weird delusion, maybe. But this goes against the locals who said, no, it was the daughter and the mother and it was a hoax. And they were trying to scare their father into moving away. So, you know, that those two theories are in conflict.
Yeah, I don't know if this counts exactly. But, I mean, there is something called, I believe it's pronounced folie à deux, where it's this shared delusion that can happen. We've talked about it on a previous episode of Monster Talk. But there are various conditions where people imagine things or experience things that an outsider might not be able to experience, but it's completely believed. People who believe that the end times are coming, you know, and they have a really strong belief that, you know, Jesus or the apocalypse or the zombies or whatever it is coming on a particular date, then they can start, accruing confirmatory evidence and ignoring disconfirmatory evidence until they're absolutely convinced that whatever is they think is true is everybody's against us, but we know this is true. And I'm probably oversimplifying that, and I'm not a psychologist, but it does exist.
I was contacted by a psychiatrist who said that maybe I should be looking into cases of folie à plusieurs, where a whole family can become taken up with some weird delusion. And I initially thought, yeah, great, this is it, because it was the whole family. But it doesn't really explain why neighbors and villagers all seem to believe in Jeff. Well, not all of them, but some of the bus depot people in Peel, you know, some the postman who said he heard Jeff. Can you expand a kind of folie à plusieurs delusion to include, you know, 20 or 30 people who don't live in the same house? It doesn't quite add up. It kind of partly explains it, but not totally.
Yeah, well, there's an interesting, I don't know how much you've looked into Bigfoot, but there is a woman named Janice Carter who believes that there is a family of Bigfoot that live around her house. And she had one that she called Fox, and she would tell people stories about how this Bigfoot would chase down deer and hunt them and bring them back to her house. And they would, you know, so they would share their kills. She was very familiar with their family. She had names for all of them. People would come to the house, and they wouldn't appear when other people were around, but there would be evidence, you know, that maybe something was going on. So, you know, as a skeptic, it's easy to say, okay, well, she's either delusional or she's making it up or she's whatever. You could make up a lot of things or you know, without going to personally investigate. But the reality is that these people can sometimes be presenting untestable claims. So if the Bigfoot will only appear when we're not around, it's going to be really hard to prove it exists.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So if you give these people who are experiencing things like this the benefit of the doubt, I guess, so to speak, it makes it really tough to investigate. And when investigators do show up, the evidence is mixed in both of these scenarios. There's things that it could be faked, and that's all we get. But there's things that are mysterious in this case, like how did they get information from across the island?
Yeah.
And I mean, so it's got elements that are still unsolved. I think that's where you're coming from.
Right?
Yeah. So I don't want to get into exactly what's going on, but you know, my personal take on it, after, you know, as an adult, not when I was a kid, my personal take was it was probably some kind of monster. But as an adult, I'm suspicious that it was probably some members of the family creating the phenomena and then taking advantage of any confirmatory or mysterious thing that they could to make it the work of Jeff. But I don't know, you know.
I think Jeff resembles Mr. Irving very closely in personality, as Christopher was saying earlier about dovetailing with his interests and his background.
Yeah, that's true too. And it's like if the whole family was in on it, they didn't have TV, you know.
I don't think it was.
Bless their hearts. I don't know. I don't know.
I don't think it was a malicious thing in any way.
Right. It's a lot different from the Bell Witch case. You mentioned that earlier, in that the Bell Witch case, first of all, if we just talk about the story inside the book that was written.
Yeah,
it was a mixture of benefit and harm that was coming from the creature, or the entity, or the witch, or however you want to call it. Yeah. And in this case, this is mostly benevolent stuff. I mean, there's not a lot of harm except for the noise and the frightening, or at least that's my take on it.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, initially he was very threatening, but after a few months, they kind of established they tried to poison him initially, thinking that he was a flesh and blood material creature, and that didn't work. So they established this truce. But again, you know, I have to say, this is all coming from James Irving's very voluminous letters and diaries. That's one thing that impressed me when I saw them. I mean, there are hundreds of pages of these. And they're all quite mundane events. You might have thought that if you were consciously faking contact with some kind of weird entity in the early 30s, you might have been talking about world affairs and the Depression and the rise of Nazism, perhaps. But it's all very, on a local level, very mundane about, farming down the road and the price of bread and this sort of thing. It doesn't seem to have been consciously faked by Irving anyway. And he said a couple of times he saw Jeff and was touched by Jeff. So one has to wonder if it was just the mother and the daughter faking it. What did he see that was touching him? What did he see running along the fence? It's very tricky. The other thing, I don't know if we've mentioned, but I think there is an aspect of sometimes when people have these mysterious, unexplained things happen to them, they're not able to provide proof, like you were talking about the Bigfoot lady. They become subject to quite a lot of pressure to deliver proof, and it's possible that this may have happened in the Jeff case, that there was something supernatural or paranormal going on. They weren't able to prove this, so they were faking, for example, the photographs or the first samples. But that's not to say the entire thing was a hoax from start to finish.
Precedent for that, yeah. We did an episode on the Columbus poltergeist, and in that particular case, the little girl who was at the center of the case was caught faking something via photographs, and her defense of that was, I'm not sure it was her defense, it may have been William Rolls, but was that maybe she was faking to get the people what they wanted, so they get out of the house and stop talking to her, badgering her, you know. So they're all here looking for evidence. She's trying to produce the evidence to just get them out of her life.
Or even to get some support from outsiders as well.
True. So let's I don't, you know, we're not here to try to hammer out the actual answer to what was Jeff, because as we said, I think it's a very complicated thing. And I'm actually extremely interested to see how your book turns out. I want to read it.
Yeah. When do you think that might be ready?
We're hoping it will be sometime next year, sometime in 2014. But you know, the curse of Jeff is always with us, and who knows what may happen. I've already spilt water all over my laptop and thankfully, I was able to retrieve the data, but I think Jeff's hand was at work there. Yeah.
So why did the public lose interest in Jeff?
I think partly because his appearances just became less and less frequent. And I think partly because there were more important things happening in the world that... excuse me, I'm just adjusting my headphones once again. He was at his heyday from 1931 to about 1937. He had a brief resurgence in 1942. There was an item in one of the local Isle of Man papers. Now he's been heard again. But I think by then, you know, there was a world war, and people had moved on. And it was kind of like, that's old news. It didn't really come to a climax. It wasn't exposed as a hoax, but equally it wasn't proven to be, you know, my God, this is something genuinely unexplainable. It kind of petered out. As the daughter grew older, or you could argue as Irving realized that he wasn't going to get anywhere with this, he wasn't going to get the attention or the book that he wanted, that Jeff's voice was heard less and less. He said he'd just be roaming around the island and he'd kind of come back now and again until he kind of disappeared. Interestingly, when Irving died, there was one or two odd things were heard in the house. It wasn't exactly Jeff's voice, but he had a long drawn out illness, so other members of the family came back. By that time, the daughter had moved out. There was another daughter, an elder daughter, who was in Liverpool. She'd come back to sort of be with the family. She said she heard these whisperings and mutterings in the rafters, and she was a complete skeptic. She thought the whole thing was nonsense. And when Irving actually died, there was apparently a broom was moving of its own accord, and but maybe that's just something that the mother and the daughter told us about or wanted us to believe.
So what happened to the family when the story started dying out? Did they leave the house? What happened to them?
They moved out after Irving died, which was, I think, in 1945 or 47. By that time, the daughter was working in a factory, still on the Isle of Man. She tried to live the whole thing down. She found it a terrible embarrassment. People were kind of partly mocking her and partly scared of her. They called her the Dalby Spook, which was, it was the name for Jeff, but it was also a name attached to her. And I think it was partly thinking she was some kind of weird possessed girl and partly that she was just a hoaxer. But she eventually moved to England, changed her name, and she refused to give interviews. She said, I don't want to talk about it. It was an awful period of my life. But there was one very persistent interviewer for Fate magazine who managed to track her down and find her address. And he was ever so persistent and just sort of doorstepped her. And she said, OK, I will talk to you. And what she said was, it had all been true. There had been this little animal that said it was a mongoose. But I wish it had never happened because he ruined my life and I could never get married, because people thought I was a freak. So it was quite poignant. I kind of feel sorry for her, because whatever it was, whether it was a joke that got out of hand or whether she was subject to some weird paranormal, you know, it didn't do her any good, is the point.
Or any of them.
No.
That's sad. Well, so Jeff is more than just an interesting story, though. It's more than just a strange phenomena. The whole story also has an interesting tie to British legal history with the BBC. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Now, this was a kind of sidebar, but it got an awful lot of press coverage, and it was quite amusing as well. Now, let me see if I can get this right. The co-author of The Haunting of Cashman's Gap was R.S. Lambert, who was the editor of The Listener. So he was connected with the BBC. But there was some kind of internal feuding within the board of governors of the BBC. And another chap called Levita. Lord Levita was somehow at odds with Lambert. And he made kind of an off-the-cuff remark, I think, at dinner, saying, this man's off his chump. You know, he believes in all sorts of superstitious, nonsensical things like the evil eye. And Lambert was kind of a friend of Price's and would, you know, accompany him with psychic investigations and so forth. So his enemy, Levita, said, this man's off his chump. He believes in the evil eye. And he's even gone to the Isle of Man to look out for a talking mongoose. And he's not fit to be on the Board of Governors. Lambert then sued him for libel, and this was a big, big case. There are even questions asked in the Houses of Parliament, which Jeff probably loved. I imagine he was very pleased to have had his name mentioned in the Mother of Parliaments.
That's funny. And it turned out in the favor of the plaintiff, right?
Yeah, he won quite a few thousand quid.
Yes, it looked like a very big settlement.
Yeah, if only poor old Irving could have got some of that.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I want to tell you that this is fantastic. I think this is going to give our listeners a really great overview. We're going to link back to the Fortean Times article. And when your book comes out, let us know.
I will.
And we'll also promote it on the show. So have you been – you've been to the Isle of Man. You said you had. So
yeah.
What's the accent like there? Does it have its own distinctive accent?
It does. It's a bit weird. It's kind of mixed with Liverpool, but then it sounds also a bit Irish. And this is a question that I haven't been able to answer, is what accent did Jeff speak with? Because a lot of people ask this. He certainly spoke some Manx words and Manx slang.
Yeah.
But that's not to say, you know, he might have just been doing that in the same way as he spoke a bit of Yiddish and a bit of German and Dutch. Yeah, it's a weird accent. It's there's also a lot of immigration from the mainland. So it's, you get people from Liverpool going over there, as the Irvings did. You get people from Lancashire. It sounds kind of a bit Irish, the old Manx accent that I've heard. Yeah,
Manx itself as a language is a dead language and died out with the last speaker in, I think, 1968 or something.
Sadly, yes.
Wow. I want to wind up, I guess. We're running a little over on time. But
we don't, but we have to.
Right, exactly. This is really good. So we'd like to ask all of our guests this question. What's your favorite monster?
When I was young, I was quite fond of the Loch Ness Monster, but I would have to say Jeff.
Jeff.
Out of loyalty, but I would have to say Jeff because I feel there's more intrigue and mystery, and the Loch Ness Monster, to my knowledge, never talked.
True. Well, yeah, maybe not.
And wasn't a poltergeist, so.
True. But you just reminded me, I think we've overlooked something really interesting that maybe we just need to throw this in here too. How did you find out about Jeff?
I've been trying to remember this, and I think when Karen mentioned the Usborne books, it was either that in the 70s, those Usborne children's books for unexplained or mysteries, where, as I remember, they had a sort of terrific little cartoon version of the human hands and the sort of fierce little face. Or it may have been a part work in the 80s, The Unexplained, which was a little magazine that came out every week, and you could bind it together like Man, Myth and Magic. And they had quite a good overview of Jeff. But it was always, like you say, Blake, it was always something in the background in your sort of teenage years. You'd read about it in these kind of compendiums of, I used to read, you know, Peter Underwood, Peter Haining, Mysteries of Britain, Ghost Stories of Britain. And Jeff would always be there as this unexplained mystery of the Isle of Man. And yeah.
And now he's got a Facebook page.
He does.
He's
got a Facebook
page, yeah, which would be very pleased.
Go and like it.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Fantastic story.
Thank you so much for talking with us today, Christopher. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Karen and Blake. I've enjoyed it.
Monster Dog.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Monster Talk. You heard Dr. Karen Stolzno and I, Blake Smith, interview researcher Christopher Joseph about the 1930s creature known as Jeff the Talking Mongoose. Monster Talk is brought to you with the support of Skeptic Magazine,
The ideas expressed on the show do not necessarily reflect those of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. Please come back and join Monster Talk in July for new episodes. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys.
To stay abreast of the latest from Skeptic Magazine and the Skeptic Society? Want cutting-edge skeptical articles delivered straight to your inbox every week? Then subscribe to eSkeptic, the free electronic newsletter of the Skeptic Society. Visit skeptic.com to sign up.
My name is Jeff.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.